Codega is a guide and a storyteller, escorting you through the night, lighting the way, warding off thieves, ghosts, demons, and other oddities. Along the journey, his companions would often share with him the most curious of stories that he'd record in his codex. Perhaps you just might find yourself traveling with the Codega and sharing one of yours. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Codega's Codex of Curiosities. I'm your guide, Rye, and tonight's curiosity, I've been looking forward to this for quite some time. I have been looking forward to this guest for a while, and he is phenomenal. So tonight's guest is going to be L.A. Marzulli. He has produced, I think it's close to now, 10 or 12 documentaries, and it's a series called Watchers. And he's also written some books as well, Nephilim Hybrids, which I have not opened yet, and On the Trail of the Nephilim as well. So tonight we are going to have L.A. Marzulli on, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I really hope you do as well. And if you don't know what the Nephilim is, or are, L.A. is going to tell us all about it. So that's going to be exciting and fascinating. I'm really looking forward to that. Now, a couple of little things I want to get through. Click that like. Yeah! If you're new here, subscribe and have the bell hit for notifications to stay up to date on all the new content. If you are listening on the audio, you know, you guys are going to hear everything and you're catching all the podcast episodes, but you are missing out on more. I have lives that I'm releasing at least once a week, and I do that with Planet 412. We do something called the the Supernatural Town Hall Sessions, where it's myself, Matt Empt from Planet 412, Andrew and JC from the Sasquatchers, and every week we have a new topic, and we dive deep into it, and sometimes we bring on a guest as well. Last week, we had on Josh Turner, and that was phenomenal. It went long. That was about 3.5 hours of discussions. Now, what else you're missing is I do other little shows. I do other little episodes as well. So what I will tell you is jump on over to the YouTube channel, check it out, subscribe, like, and hopefully you enjoy that as well. And with that, I'm going to bring on L.A. Marzulli. All right, LA, thank you, and welcome to Codega's Codex of Curiosities. It's an honor to have you on my show.
Well, the honor's all mine, and thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. So like I said, I record on the rooftop, and I'm in Mexico, so every now and then I do get the odd motorbike driving by, but then the brakes. That's what I have to put up with living here, so... So why don't you tell our listeners and our viewers a little bit about yourself and where they can find you?
I am L.A. Marzulli. I'm the author of 13 and a half books. I say half because we're about a little over halfway for number 14, which will be The Rungs on the UFO Disclosure Ladder. That's the working title. There are 28 films in our stable, 28 films. Two more will be added probably by the end of April, bringing the total up to 30. There are now 8 films on the UFO phenomena, and the last two will be a total of 10 films. So, you know, I'm a frank supernaturalist. I believe that the supernatural world is all around us, and sometimes it does manifest to people like you and me. You can go to lamarzulli.net. That's the major website, or lamarzulli.com. That'll get you there too. And all of our DVDs are available on our streaming site, streaming.lamarzulli.net.
That is fantastic. And when you're saying that it's all the supernatural is all around us, are you implying that we're kind of overlaid with other worlds? Is that what you're kind of implying by that?
Well, yes and no. I mean,
okay.
I think if we could see into the supernatural, if we could pull back the veil and see what's around us, I think we'd all be absolutely stupefied at what we see. And this happens to some people. for a brief period of time, maybe 30 seconds, maybe 50 seconds, where the veil is dropped and they see an angel that's 14 feet tall in shining armor standing in front of their child's bedroom with a sword drawn. I mean, how is that possible? I mean, I've had stuff happen to me in 44 years as a Christian. I became a Christian 44 years ago when I was 30 years old. So I'm 73. So, I mean, I've had a lot of stuff happen to me over the years, which are frankly supernatural experiences. I mean, there's just no way around it, including UFO sightings and all sorts of other stuff. The supernatural world is very much real, but we don't see it. And it doesn't matter, but it does manifest from time to time. You know, it does manifest to people like you and me. So, you know, when it does, it's an eye opener.
It is. I've had actually numerous paranormal experiences, and I regularly see things peeking around the corner, running past doorways, especially here in the Yucatan. Oh, yeah. I see a lot of little things, we'll say, running by and just kind of like peeking around corners. It's almost on a regular basis. So it's quite amazing. You know, it's gotten to the point where it's just like, there's something else. You know, it's less shocking. I think the shock value has dropped, and it's just become more interesting.
Well, you know, where you are, if I may say so, in the Yucatan, I mean, when you look at those sites, just let's say Chichen Itza, how many thousands of people were ritualistically sacrificed when the Europeans came over and they went up to the top of the pyramid? People were, you know, freaked out because in that area, all these human hearts were, you know, being displayed. So it's a very bloodthirsty, extremely bloodthirsty area. And that area has never been reclaimed. In other words, the work's never been done. So you're sitting in a portal, a gateway, which is why you're seeing stuff run by. And who knows other stuff that you're not seeing. So the principality that controls that area has never been deposed. It still rules. I was invited to Chichen Itza in 2012. At the very last minute, we had a dream from a very, very close person to me, and we didn't go. We got confirmation, and at the same time we're getting the confirmation, my battle buddy, Russ Dizdar, is up in his prayer closet, and he's wrestling with the fact that the Lord's told him, don't go to Chichen Itza. So he comes down. His message machine is beeping, and it's me on the phone saying, I know this sounds crazy, but we're not going. And, you know, we had one guy specifically, ex-Navy SEAL, as a bodyguard. He was going to accompany us. And the other guy was, you know, pretty much in the same line. You know, the guy was pretty buff and could take care of himself and then some. So it's, you know, that whole area is just rife with human sacrifice. And anytime human sacrifice is there and blood is spilled, that opens up the gateway to the demonic, to the fallen angels, to, you know, really evil, evil, evil stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that one. And there's the sister city of Chichen Itza that a lot of people don't know about, and that's called Mayapan. And it's closer to Chichen Itza is maybe closer to Cancun. Mayapan is closer to the city called Merida. And there you can actually explore a lot further. It's not as well maintained as you're going to find in Chichen Itza, but it's a very interesting site as well to go in. And yeah, it's heavy. I will say that it feels heavy when you're in those locations. And definitely, yeah, there have been the sacrifices. We don't know the full amount of numbers that have been sacrificed there. And some went willingly for this, whereas others, they didn't. But and you're also saying that, like, you know, the dream guided you or guided your friend away from this. And that's really, really interesting. That's something I follow my dreams a lot. I have really prophetic and intense dreams. And it's kind of funny because I was scrolling through your website here just before you came on, and I saw the red heifer ritual. And last night, in my dream, I was being chased by it looked like a bull, but it was like a flaming red bull. And I was trying to escape from this building, and it was almost a pyramid type shaped building. that we were trying to escape from. And it ended up being a certain individual and a name, perfect name. I don't know who this person is. Brett Kavanaugh sacrificed himself so that we could escape from this enclosure.
You don't
from
know
this...
who Brett Kavanaugh is?
No. Should I know that name? That name rings a bell, but I'm like, who is that?
He's one of the justices on the Supreme Court.
Really?
Yeah.
Brent yes. Kavanaugh. Okay. And I don't know the U.S. as well because I am Canadian. So, but that name rang a bell. So that's fascinating. That is really interesting.
It is.
Mm-hmm. That's something I want to look into a little. Well, you know, on my own time, I'm going to go dive into that a little bit deeper. But yeah, this red flaming bull that was pursuing and trying to sacrifice. In essence, it was trying to sacrifice hordes of people. Really interesting. So LA Marzulli, what is your main forte when it comes to research? What do you go after? What is your drive?
Well, I mean, a lot of it, the overarching umbrella is the biblical narrative. I mean, that's what that's what we're into. And specifically the Nephilim, UFOs, and some of the supernatural things like Fatima. We made two films on Fatima, but there are, you know, 13 and a half books. Many of them deal with either the UFO phenomena or being on the trail of a Nephilim. And, you know, that's what we do. I spend time in the library. I get that, but I'm also out in the field, very much so out in the field and looking and exploring and filming out in different sites all over the world. And, you know, we've got some things on the docket for September. We'll see what happens. And hopefully those trips will happen. And we'll be filming for about 10 days in an undisclosed location over across the pond. But I mean, that's, you know, there's a byline that I say, there is a hidden history that's been deliberately obfuscated from the peoples of the world. And there is, I mean, there's no doubt about it. If you want to become an archaeologist, you have to toe the line. Because if you get a degree in archaeology, what are you going to do with it? Well, in order to get funding, in order to be in a museum, the curator of a museum, in order to do anything, you've got to toe the party line. And the party line essentially says, there is no supernatural. There's spiritual things, but there is no supernatural. Basically, they adhere to a Darwinian paradigm. Of course, because I'm not tenured and I don't have the golden handcuffs, I'm not tied to a museum or a certain university, I'm actually free to think. I can actually go and look and research and then write what I think we're looking at. Now in academia, normally you really can't do that. If you go up and buck against the system, you don't get promoted. You could lose tenure. You could lose your job. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And I'm not making this up. We're going to be releasing a film sometime this year. We actually filmed it last summer. And this film, well, it's just like, you know, you talked about the Piraka skulls.
Yes.
Our team, and we had a boatload of money from a couple, and they always want to remain anonymous. But thank you if you're watching this again. But they gave us the funding that we needed to assemble the team and go down and procure the DNA. And we did. And the DNA evidence showed pretty much conclusively that these elongated skulls in Paracas originated in the Middle East or in Eastern Europe. The mitochondrial DNA, which is from the mother side of the equation, showed a Middle Eastern or Eastern European, Baltic area, Black Sea area, rewrites history. You know, and the academics don't like that because it rewrites history. It goes completely against what they believe. And so they just come up with straw man arguments. Oh, you're a pseudo-archaeologist. That's what they'll call someone like me. Well, okay, why don't we just drop the names and let's look at the evidence? I don't care what you think about me. Stop giving me a goofy label. What does the DNA say? Oh, it's all contaminated. Okay, let's back up. How do you know it's all contaminated? If it was contaminated, why didn't we get nuclear DNA? If it was contaminated with my DNA and Mondo's DNA, one sample was contaminated with my DNA. We threw it out. So the other samples, 56 samples, so now there's 55, those are uncontaminated. Our protocols, Rye, were so stringent. We had some people go, wow, LA, this looks like a CSI, you know, film. And it did. We had full-blown lab suits, masks, hats, full-blown suits, double sleeves, gloves, boots, the whole thing. And we had about, I think we had about 80 changes, something like that.
And like, I can imagine that, you know, especially if you're, you know, going against the narrative or going against the flow, you have to, you know, cross your T's and dot your I's. You yourself have to be so sure. And I can see that you are doing that, which is fantastic.
Well, we try to. We're not perfect, but we're all, you know, and we've made mistakes and we'll make mistakes in the future. But we're out in the field when we're doing it. We discovered something and I can't talk about it yet because we don't even have, you know, I'm looking at my edit suite over there. I haven't even started editing it. And yeah, there's a lot of film that we did. But basically, it will set the record straight, in our opinion, on who built the mounds in all through America. Because, you know, modern day archaeologists, Native Americans built these mounds. Well, there's advanced geometry in these mounds. And Native Americans, 1,000 years ago, did not have advanced geometry. But it goes so deep, I can't talk about it. But wait, when the film comes out, you got to have me back on. Roswell films, you know? So, you know, I've been following Roswell since I was a kid, all right? But we did, this one here is called Exoneration. We flew to Montana. We interviewed Jesse Marcel Jr.'s widow, Linda, one of his best friends, and then his daughter, and then other people like Tim Alberino talking about, you know, Roswell and what happened. But then we went out to the debris field here, and that's a piece of the metal that we found right there.
Really?
Yeah, we actually found two pieces of metal. We had the metal tested. The closest thing that comes to it is an aluminum 7000 series, but that aluminum 7000 series wasn't invented till 1953. This metal is folded. You can take a look at it and see what I'm talking about. You can see it right there. The metal is folded up on itself. Let me get
yes,
out of the light.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I can see that.
The metallurgist just looked at it and said, whatever happened to this thing, high stress, high heat. So there's a clip that we show from one of the Air Force bases, and it shows a disc coming down like this and then hitting the ground and then skipping back up and then coming down again. And when it comes down the second time, it just explodes. And hundreds of shards just go out. That's what we think happened at Roswell. The craft, it was a skip site. It came in, it skipped, part of it exploded, and it went another several miles, and then that's where the craft and the bodies were found. There's two sites. Marcel Sr. was only at the first site, which is why he never saw the bodies or the actual intact craft. But the shards of that metal from the explosion went down into the ground. That's why when we're out there, it's all in the film. We're out there with metal detectors, and Frank Kimber goes, hey, guys, I got a hit. And we come over, we show it all on film, and he digs the thing out. It's like down 6 to 8 inches. He digs it out, and there it is, the palm of his hand. I mean, we're not making this stuff up. They didn't get it all, Rye. They didn't get it all because in order to completely clean that up, they'd have to go in with a bulldozer and scrape everything. And they did that, by the way, at the second site. They removed a ton of dirt, and it's all enclosed in a fence. But the first site is open cattle range. They didn't get it all. And then there's I just interviewed this gentleman at a conference in Texas, and he came up to me and said his grandmother worked at the Roswell base basically all her life, like 30 years, worked there. And she was there when the wreck happened. And she told her grandson, they were right by Hangar 84. And he asked her kind of jokingly, is this where they took the bodies? And she said, yes, but we weren't allowed to see them. And he kept waiting for her, you know, gotcha. No, she was dead serious.
She was a matter of factly. Yes. So that sort of sounds like a matter of fact kind of answer.
Exactly. And then she talks about, you know, that the wreckage and the bodies were kept there. We got into Hangar 84. We filmed inside the hangar. We show that in the film. Now, I've seen that in other documentaries. I've always dreamed about, and we got in. You know, it's just, yeah, the guy upstairs opened the doors, and we got in. And, you know, we discussed a lot of stuff. She, you know, she told us that that's where the wreckage and the body was scored. Walter G. Hout said exactly the same thing in a deathbed affidavit. So it wasn't open. The affidavit was sealed until the time of his death. And in that, he states that the wreckage was there in Hangar 84. He saw it. He saw the bodies under a tarp. I mean, you know, you're not making this stuff up. How many witnesses do we need before you realize that, just like David Grush said recently in front of Congress, that yes, we have retrieved crash one. Yes, we retrieved the pilots of those craft, and the biologics were non-human, non-human biologics. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. So if, you know, and I hope, you know, it just amazes me. People want everything for free. Well, we have an hour together, roughly.
Yeah.
The first film was an hour and a half long. The second film was over an hour. So we can't, and you can't possibly get into all the visuals and everything else that are part of the film. So for the price less of a cup of coffee at Starbucks, $5, you know, coffee now at Starbucks through the roof, $7, $8, $9, right? For a cup of Joe, give me a break. So, you know, you can go to streaming, like a stream, streaming.lamarzulli.net, and you can download all the UFO films and you can come up to speed. Because we've done the homework. We've done the heavy lifting.
And I can only imagine how much time and effort goes into even just an hour documentary. Like, I'm making one of my own documentaries as we speak right now. And I know how much time and effort goes into that. And I'm just a one-man kind of guy trying to make a basic documentary. So I can only imagine the amount of time that you're going out to all these sites. It's a lot of work and a lot of money. As well.
It's a lot of work, a lot of money. And, you know, in some ways, it's a thankless job. I mean, if we were selling, like, you know, 100,000 DVDs, I'd be tickled. We don't. We sell maybe between 5 and 10,000, you know, per show. Now, over the course of the lifespan with the streaming site, so we're looking for marketing people. And that's, I've got a call tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I signed the contract with a very large marketing firm. We'll see what happens with that. We've got to get our website tuned up, and I've got a meeting on Saturday and Sunday with that. So, I mean, you know, we're working full time to try to get the word out.
And that's what this is as well too. You know, you do these shows and it helps promote your, you know, it's all promotion as well. Yeah. Like, I know I heard you on Tony on the Confessionals, and I'm assuming that would help a lot. Tony's probably one of the biggest out there. So, fantastic. So why don't we go back into this to the Paracas skulls? You said the DNA was coming from the Middle East. Now, the mother DNA. So are you relating that possibly that the Nephilim, of course, and my understanding, are the offspring of the fallen angels with human women.
Correct.
So that the fallen angels possibly, you know, at this location were in the Middle East.
Correct. Well, that's where they came down. Mount Hermon is Nephilim Central. That's where the 200 Watcher Angels, according to the Book of Enoch, in the days of Jared, descended on Mount Hermon. They created an oath with them, and that's what the whole basis of Countermove, how the Nephilim returned after the flood, is really about. But they, when Joshua and Caleb came in to the Promised Land, the Nephilim tribes are there. The Anakim, the Zanzamim, the Emims, the Rephaim, they're all there. The Horites, they're all there. Each of them may have different genetic characteristics. So the Paracas skulls, the Paracas people, show up about 3,500 years ago. They appear out of nowhere on the shores of Peru. There's also date palms around Paracas. Nowhere else, just Paracas. Date palms only grow in the Middle East. Thank you, Brian Forrester, for pointing that out. But it was the work of our anthropologist, Rick Woodward, that really shed light on what these things are. in our sixth film. Oh, LA, they're always talking about buying another film. Well, then be ignorant the rest of your life. You know, I'm not going to give it to you for free because then I know you won't watch it.
Exactly. You know, as soon as you give something for free, people don't put value to it.
No value. So that's number six in the DNA on the trail of the Nephilim, the DNA evidence. We have medical doctors, surgeons, archaeologists, anthropologists, optometrists, chiropractors, and other people. It's a multidiscipline team coming on the record and stating that whatever this is genetic. It's genetic. It's not human. It's genetic. And the DNA proves that its origin is in the Middle East. So the question is, and this is the work of Rick Woodward, and we'll get into this. When you deconstruct this, first of all, the pupillary distance between one eye and the other eye should be about 65 millimeters. It's 45 millimeters, which means the pupils are closer together, which means that this entity more than likely had night vision. The orbits are 25 to 30% larger than a human being. The zygomatic arch, which is this area right here, very, very pronounced and robust. We don't have these features. The sutures here, this is a sagittal, this is a suture, and that suture should be here, called a sagittal suture. But this, look at it. It's completely missing. There's no vestige of it.
It's not there.
Not there. The smoking gun was given to us by Rick Woodward, who is our team's anthropologist. This is the foramen magnum. This is where the spinal column attaches to the brain, right here. Now, the white part that you're seeing, okay, is clay. Joe Taylor, who did the mold, created the clay when he did, this is a mold, okay? So in order to have it sit up, he goes in, puts clay around it, sticks a dowel in there, and that becomes the mold. So what you're looking at is the mold that Joe did. But when you come around here and you look at it, this is the foramen magnum, this whole area right in here. You can see it right there. If it's any further back, let me get this straight up. If it's any further back, it's outside the skull. You can see that. That foramen magnum should be here. Should be right in the center of the skull. That's where it should be. It should be right here in the center of the skull. It's not. It's not there. It's kind of hard to get things in the camera. It cracks me up.
That's okay. That's okay.
But it should be right here. Right there. Right there. And it's not. You cannot move the foramen magnum. You can't do it. It's impossible. It happens in the entity in utero, why it's in the room. So what is this thing doing all the way in the back? And that's the smoking gun. And no one has ever, you know, I mean, somebody could start writing rebuttals. Nobody writes a rebuttal. Gee, I wonder why. I had a molecular biologist come up to me at a conference about a year ago. And he said, you know, LA, you don't know me and I can't come on the record because I'm in academia. I'm in the scientific community and I'll lose my job. But he said, your work, you and your team's work on the Paraca skulls have created an undercurrent in academia and the scientific community. People were talking at the water cooler, off the record, because, you know, you got to be careful. And, you know, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I would like to think that it is true. I would like to think that we're making a difference instead of the typical, oh, you're a pseudo-archaeologist. Well, then go out and prove me wrong. If I'm a pseudo-archaeologist, you go down the Paracas, you take 56 samples, you do the sequencing, you spend tens of thousands of dollars, and then we'll have a discussion. Otherwise, shut up. You know, you have no idea what you're talking about.
And
our team's archaeologist, Mondo Gonzalez, you know, he drew up the report with the DNA. That's why we hired Mondo, because he was an archaeologist. But Richard Shaw, my late business partner, he filmed it all. Chase Klotsky tagged and bagged everything. I mean, our protocols were very stringent, and we had a Dremel tool. And so when we went into the skull, we would immediately turn the skull over. And right here at the foramen magnum, you can see right here. Let me get that. Right here at the foramen magnum. This and this. We would take a Dremel tool and we would just go and get rid of the outer layer. And that means we could go in right here and get fresh material, which is what we did on all the skulls. And that would, we would hold the skull like this, and the material would drop into a brand new sheet of paper from an unopened stack. And then once the material is there, we would fold the paper in half, and then Chase Klotzke would be standing with a vial, tap, 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 tap. All that material goes into the vial, sealed, bagged and tagged, done. I mean, you know, our protocols are very stringent. Yep. That paper is crumpled up, thrown in the waste paper basket. We take compressed air, we blow the whole site over, we go out of the room, we change out of our lab gear, blow each other with compressed air, then put on brand new lab gear, brand new coat, brand new hat, brand new mask, brand new gloves, double arms, whole deal. And then we go back in and they bring a new skull and we do the same process.
So what you're telling me is you had 56 skulls.
We had 56 samples. We had about 18 skulls.
Oh, how many skulls? Sorry.
18.
That's a lot still. 18 is a lot.
It's a lot. Nine from the ICA Museum, nine from the ICA Museum, nine from Senior Juan's Paracas Museum. And the best samples came from Senior Juan's Museum because they were fresh.
When you say fresh, how old were those skulls, if you had to estimate? I know you said around they started appearing around, what you said, 3,000 or 3,500 years ago?
3,500 years ago. We did. It's so funny. Once again, we had carbon 14 dating. So once they got wind of L.A. Marzulli, oh, I'm a pseudo-archaeologist. Oh, this is pseudoscience. Well, excuse me, how is it pseudoscience when I'm taking a sample and I'm just asking for carbon 14? You know, because what, I'm not tied to a university? Is that what you're afraid of? That's censorship. That's discrimination. I could take it to a lawyer. I won't, but I could, because it's out-and-out discrimination. So before they knew who I was or wasn't, we had the baby skull, which you see back here.
Yes.
We had carbon 14 dating with it because it was wrapped in mummy wrappings. And we unwrapped that mummy. And that's the baby. Huge elongated skull, reddish hair, huge orbits. I mean, it fits all the same criteria that we just talked about. So we had it tested. It was basically 1,935 years old.
1,935.
Rounded up to 2,000 years.
Yeah.
It was plus or minus 50. So rounded up to 2,000 years old. I mean, who gets to do that? You know, and we did. And we published our results. People don't like the results. You know, they just don't, because it rewrites history. It goes against the prevailing paradigm. This new film that we're working on will do exactly the same thing in regard to the sites in the Americas, because, you know, there is a hidden history. This is the byline. There's a hidden history that's been deliberately obfuscated from the peoples of the world. And that's why I am on the trail of a Nephilim. That's what we do.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, it's, you know, I find that academia doesn't want to, you know, they get so stuck on something and they don't want to admit that we are wrong, or they know they're wrong and they don't want to. It's ridiculous, you know, and that's a sign of a good scientist, I believe, is one who's willing to entertain any idea, no matter how far out it could be. You know, you have to, as a good scientist, you have to entertain every idea. And if it, you know, if it breaks what you believe in, you have to allow that.
You have to go where the evidence, if the evidence showed that all these skulls originated in Asia, we'd all go home. That would be it. But our hypothesis was exactly, you know, our hypothesis was that Joshua and Caleb, when they went into the promised land and they began to completely eliminate these Nephilim tribes, there was a diaspora. They fled. How do we know there was a stelae on North Africa, the shores of North Africa? We are they who fled from the face of Joshua the robber, the son of Nun. Procopius wrote it down. What's that doing? What's that stelae, that stone carved in writing? you know, on the north shore of Africa. We are they who fled from the face of Joshua the robber, the son of Nun. That's who it is. It's the same Joshua in the biblical narrative. Procopius writes it down. He's got no Nephilim dog in the hunt. That tribe in northern Africa, they were Nephilim. They migrated, they island hopped all through the Mediterranean. And you can see the vestiges of them all throughout there. They land in Menga, Spain, huge dolmens. They go over to Portugal, huge dolmens, artifacts like you can't even believe. They go into France, 80,000 standing stones in Karnak. They come up into England. They go over to Ireland. Then they island hop, or not continent, but island hop, like Iceland and Newfoundland. They go like that and land in Canada and then come back down. And the copper in Michigan, tons of copper has gone missing. So, you know,
yes.
Quit lying to us because, you know, we're just tired of it, you know, and quit calling us names. Sit down and let's have a discussion.
Exactly. Let's have a discussion instead of like throwing temper tantrums and kicking people out and saying, no, you're not allowed here anymore. Like that's
exactly what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. That's crazy. So you had said red hair. So that's something I've noticed as well, that a lot of Nephilim, you know, have this red hair. Is that a common trait, or are there other Nephilim with other hair? Like, you know, they talk about the giant in Kandahar as well with the red hair as well. Is there any other thing that you've heard of as well?
Whether you know that, Rye, or not, I gotta set you straight. You may know this, but my business partner who passed away several years ago, Richard Shaw, we broke the story on the Kandahar giant.
Really?
You didn't know that,
wow.
Did you? Yeah.
We
broke the story. Other people have copied it. They get a gazillion hits. We broke the story. We interviewed the shooter, you know, and I mean, we did it. We broke the story on the Kandahar giant. I was threatened by a guy from the deep state because he didn't like
it. Really?
Him. Yeah. Yeah. We
I got to have you back on just to talk about this.
No, I mean, we broke the story. It's in Watchers 10. We broke the story. It's our story. And people have just copied it endlessly. But we broke it. We're the ones that did the research. We
often imitated, never duplicated, right?
There it is. Unbelievable.
Well, then I will say thank you. Thank you for breaking that story and you know, bringing it to light, because that is huge. That is huge.
No pun intended.
I didn't even realize I was doing that. So the hair then, red hair, is that the common trait, or are there other?
We don't know. I mean, we don't know. That's, you see, the problem is we've got some evidence. A lot of the evidence has been taken away, you know, hustled off into some dark, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark, packed up in a crate and then you never see it again. Nothing to see here, keep moving. We don't have all the information. So you can't say, is this a predominant trait? It seems to be. It seems to be, but we don't know.
No, that's really interesting, though, as well. What about, so when we go back into the Bible and we start talking about the men of renown, those are, you know, those are Nephilim. Or even if we go into... you know, we talk about Greek mythology as well. You know, people talk about, oh, Hercules, and, you know, he was, you know, the son of Zeus, but, you know, of a regular woman. And I'm like, well, that's a Nephilim.
Yeah, Hercules, that is, Greek mythos, Hercules is a Nephilim. That's what he is.
Yeah. Now, were the Nephilim always the bad guys? You know, were they always these terrible beings, or were they, some of them, you know, kind or benevolent, or what is your thoughts on that?
They're in a fixed state. They are cannibalistic. They are sexually deviant. They are incredibly evil on all fronts. End of story.
So nothing else like that. They perhaps are portrayed in some other lights, you know, to be these greater beings of sorts, but in reality, maybe it's just people groveling and trying to gain favor from them. Maybe is that why some of them are written in a better light?
You know, that's conjecture, and I really don't have an answer to that. I mean, it's possible. They were were really despicable. And this is why there's no grace and mercy from a loving, holy God. Wherever the Nephilim are, the mandate's always the same. Wipe them all out. Wipe them all out. Because, first of all, in my opinion, they're soulless. They have no soul. Second of all, they're sexually deviant. They used to drink the blood of humans. They were cannibalistic. So this has no room at all in God's creation. And this is why, because they're the sons, they're the sons of the fallen angels. That's what they are. And that's why they're all wiped out, to make sure that the DNA is not passed down, to make sure that the DNA is not intermingling with us, with real human beings. What's at stake here is Genesis 3:15. I got this from my elder brother, Gary Stearman. When Adam and Eve blow it, so they're in the garden. Adam and Eve are over here. The dragon's over here. In the center is the pre-incarnate Jesus. And he says something to the dragon, which is incredibly pregnant with meaning. Your seed, your offspring to the dragon, your offspring to the dragon will be at war at enmity with the seed, the offspring of the woman. The proto-evangelion, the Messiah, will come and crush your head. You will bruise his heel. That's right. That's the gateway to the Bible. If we understand Genesis 3:15, then we understand Genesis 6, Tower of Babel, Abraham and the kings, Sodom and Gomorrah, the conquest of Canaan, Daniel chapter 2:43, where it says, their seed will mingle with the seed of men. They will not cleave to them. Finally, the son of perdition. The Antichrist is the son of perdition. He is, in my opinion, a Nephilim.
So you, by all sense and purposes, you believe that the Nephilim is still around to this day and trying to, I'll say, infect the human race, you know, try to create hybrids of sorts.
Well, that's what the whole, when you talk to Karen Wilkinson, you know, we published Karen's book. We just spent the weekend with them at the Orlando conference, Karen and her husband, Dave. There's a breeding program. Their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not cleave to them. That's Daniel 2:43. Daniel, seal up the words of the book to the time of the end. Men will run to and fro over the face of the earth. Knowledge will increase. Men and women don't run to and fro over the face of the earth till the advent of the airplane. Now we run to and fro over the face of the earth. Knowledge was flatline until Gutenberg's printing press. Then you get a spike. But from the Industrial Revolution on, it's like up and up and up we go. Now knowledge increases exponentially about, what is it, every 4 to 6 months or whatever. So the time of the end is here. The book is unsealed. And now we know, and you can ask Karen this, you know, the seed is being taken, the stolen seed, evil harvest from the women. Sperm is taken from the men. It's the days of Noah. Jesus warns us it would be like the days of Noah when he returns. And Jesus is giving us a huge opening here to explore. What differentiates the days of Noah is the presence of the B'nai HaElohim, the fallen angels, which are still around, still creating their mischief and creating hybrids. But the seed is no longer mingling. And it's mingling, rather. The seed is mingling, but there's no cleaving. There's no marriage contract like there was in Genesis 6, that the angels left their first estate and had intercourse with the women of earth and married them, took wives. No marriage. Talk to Karen about that. They're just, she's used as a breeder. Women are used as a breeder. Men are used for their sperm.
Yeah, I had a couple of abductees that I've interviewed. One of them, his name is Raphael, and he's pretty much a lifelong abductee. And he recounts one episode where he was put into a room. I can't remember the description of the room, but he was given a baby, and he knew that this was
his.
Yeah, and he says it was not, you know, it looked slightly human, but it looked different
more alien
as well.
Than human, yeah. How many?
Yeah.
I would say that probably happened in the 1990s. Am I right?
I think it was possibly 90s and 2000s as well.
Okay,
yes.
In the 90s, they looked very alien. In the 2000s, they were the short, black-eyed kids. And then from there, like 2010 and up, now the hybrids are walking amongst us.
Yeah, and he talks about hybrids. He talks about hybrids as well. And then I had another guest on, Ginger, and she's kind of a lifelong abductee, but she's a lot in denial right now about it. Like, it's really, really affected her. It's been a very traumatic experience, and sure. It all happened when she was 8 years old. And it's very difficult for her, and she's turning it around. You know, after coming on, the first time she ever talked about it was on my show, and now she's turning her life around, and she wants to start her own show as well. She's empowering herself, you know, after living in darkness for so long. And I'm not saying I did this. It was her being brave and stepping forward. So, that's what I think as well, is this, you know, harvest. It's exactly what they're doing.
You should put her in touch with Karen. Karen could really help her.
It's funny you say that, because I heard Karen's interview on Tony. It was either Tony's or Tinfoil Hats. It was one of the two. And I said, I said to Ginger, I'm like, you gotta listen to her. And she did. And I'm like, and I'm gonna get her on my show, you know. And she's pretty excited about that. Yes, yeah. So I think Ginger could definitely use some help with talking with Karen on that one. Mm-hmm. No, this is really fascinating. It's intriguing, but it also is a little scary as well. You know, it's what you don't see, this hidden movements that are being, just hidden from us. And I can see it out in the periphery, but it's like, when is this final play going to happen? You know, when are these, and you say they're walking among us right now, the hybrids, how would you describe that, a hybrid now? What would be your definition of, if you were to say these are possibly traits or something to look out for if you're encountering a hybrid?
They're obsessed with having sex with us. They want to mate. And they just, that's all they think about is mating, you know, creating more hybrids. They're obsessed with it. How do I know that? I have two women, one from Norway, who appeared to this guy, and she's wearing a see-through dress. And, you know, he's at the market. It's a beautiful summer day in Norway. He and his wife are shopping in the vegetable section. At the end of the aisle, 50 feet away, this woman appears, bam, out of nowhere. And instead of walking down the aisle, she's still upright. She serpentines like this. And now she's standing in front of the man with this glaring hate. The woman, the wife, is behind the vegetable stand. She's completely freaked out. She lifts up her dress. She's not wearing any underwear. And at this point, the man turns his face, and then he remembers, rebuke first, ask questions later. The Lord rebuke you. In the name of Jesus, the Lord rebuke you. So she's right here in front of his face. All of a sudden, bam. When he says that, she's 50 feet away at the end of the aisle in a flash, in a split second. And then he looks at her one more time, and then it's gone, just like that. And the other one,
his wife witnessed this as well, too, with him.
Yeah, she was freaked out. And the other one is Al Matthews, who had this encounter with the woman. And Al's a professional mover. They're on a freight elevator. And this woman is wearing these dark wraparound glasses. And Al doesn't say anything. He figures, well, you know, she's got an eye problem. So they're together in the freight elevator to go look at her belongings, because she just came in from Kuwait. And she looks at him and says, they're listening, Al. It's just the two of them on the elevator. They're listening, Al. And Al goes, who's listening? And she goes, you know, the Grays. We were supposed to meet on the ship. So Al gives this woman his phone number, and she's hounding him constantly to try to have sex with him. And Al's saying, no, I'm not doing it. One night, in a moment of weakness after work, he goes up to see her. Well, she's with a friend at the friend's apartment, which is why I guess Al went up. She's wearing a dark glasses. She and her friend are drinking wine out of these huge goblets. And all of a sudden, this deer fly, very large fly, lands on the edge of the glass. Al goes, I'll get it. You know, let me get a Kleenex and I'll get it for you. She goes, no, I have it. She leans forward like this and the fly sticks to her finger. She doesn't grab it, doesn't grab the fly. The fly sticks to her finger. She brings it up to her mouth. It's still like 6 inches away, and she goes like that and sucks it in. How's that possible?
Wow.
How's that possible? And then she takes off the dark glasses, and she goes over and she sits on Al's lap, lifts up his shirt, rubs his chest, and goes, "My, you're well preserved." And I stop him right there, and I go, "Al, you have a girlfriend. Is this normal behavior for you?" He goes, "No, not at all. It's the first time someone's," we call it UFO brain fog, because when you're around these entities, you can't think clear. So, you know, she's pulling up his shirt. She's trying to get him aroused, obviously. And she leans forward to kiss him. Al pushes her away. And when he pushes her away, the eyes shapeshift. Golden specks, dark black, you know, serpentine type deals.
Yeah.
And she lands on the floor and she lets out the most evil laugh you've ever heard. Al flees the scene, goes running out of there. And he went over to a mutual friend, Gordy Tong. And Gordy Skyped me, and we talked to Al, talked him off the ledge. We gave him resources. 2 weeks later, he came of the Lord. 2 weeks later, he gave his life to Jesus. It stopped the abductions. It stopped all the nonsense.
It reminds me of a friend of mine, Barton Nunley. He is a avid, I would say almost a hunter of, he calls them inhumanoids, like Bigfoot, Dogman. And yeah, he believes them, that they are the Nephilim. And he had a lot of interactions with them until he rebuked them in the name of Jesus, you know, in the name of the Lord. He doesn't see them anymore. He doesn't have any of these interactions that he used to have. And he's quite a very interesting gentleman. And it's really, really interesting.
Hey, send me his link, will you? I'd love to have him on my show and to talk to him. That'd be really great.
Definitely. Yeah. Barton's a great, great Southern kind of easygoing guy. Cool. I will definitely do that, Lane Marzulli. I know we're getting closer to the end. Now, I had a question, and now I'm trying to remember. But, well, Bigfoot, Dogman, all these other cryptids, Nephilim or creations of something else?
Nephilim, in my opinion, all day long. The late Scott Carpenter and I talked about this.
Okay.
He was on my show several times. Actually,
great guy.
About it. Yeah, great guy. I would say that they got him.
I believe so too.
Yeah.
I believe so as well.
Yeah, they got him. This stuff is, you know, I got to tell you, man, part of what I do, it makes me wonder sometimes, you know, sometimes the attack from the enemy is just so intense. The dreams, the frontal attack, you know, you'll go to a site and all of a sudden you're just getting pressurized and you know who it is. You know, you mentioned Chichen Itza in the beginning of the film. That's a charged site, man. That's a, you know, to the max, that thing is charged. So, you know, am I going to wander into Chichen Itza? I'd have to get some marching orders. That's like going in the Hell's Kitchen. It really is.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of people, they don't realize. And it kind of brings me almost to like the new age spirituality. You know, I was in that to begin with.
So was I.
Yeah. And, you know, like I was born and raised Catholic, really hardcore Catholic. Yeah. And then I, you know, moved away to try to find my own path.
Right.
And one of the, you know, I read a book called Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh. And that was, it kind of moved me away and it pushed me down a different path. And then I started going down to the path of this new age. And I find the new age is it's a quagmire where it's all this love and light. We're all going to disguise everything with love and light, but you never actually look at yourself and deal with your own issues. Yeah. And that's something that, and you know, I stepped away from it all. And I would say in the last like 4 or 5 years, I really stepped back to Jesus and Christ. And I wouldn't say I'm not going to church, but I would say I'm closer to God than I think I've almost ever been.
Well, I mean, bully for you. And that's, I mean, it's a personal relationship with Jesus. And we realize that he is the Son of God. He is God.
Yep.
And you know, the sacrifice that he made for us is unbelievable. He actually becomes death. And that's why the enemy, the dragon, Satan, didn't figure out what's he doing here. He didn't understand what, how's he going to crush my head? Well, it says that, you know, he is the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. The firstborn from the dead. For in him the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. And through him, he reconciled all things in earth and in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. So Jesus is on the cross, and he dies. The body goes to the tomb, but his spirit and his soul descend to the lower parts of the earth, Tartarus. There he preaches, declares to the fallen angels which are in prison, not getting out, no jailbreak, checkmate, it's over. I got the keys right here. It's over. Because the dragon, Satan, never could imagine that God would die because he's dead. He's separated from, he's fully God, fully man. He's separated from his body. The body is in the tomb. There's no doubt about it. Body's in the tomb. And his soul and his spirit go down to Tartarus. 3 days later, his soul and his spirit reunite with the body, he's resurrected. That's a type of the rapture, right? For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel and the trump of God. The dead in Christ will rise first. Those are the bodies in the tombs. Then we who are alive, right, will ascend into the clouds to greet the Lord in the air, and so shall we evermore be with the Lord. So those of us who are alive and get raptured, there is no separation. We go up and our sin natures falls away. But for those who are dead in Christ, they rise first. Their bodies rise up and you reunited with their soul and their spirit. And we're not talking, you know, zombies here. The body is rejuvenated, just like Jesus's body. Its rigor mortis is set in. He's dead. There's no life there, but there is life there. And that picture right behind me, that's the face of the shroud. And
yes, I know that. Yeah. I know that all too well. Yeah.
I'm an amateur sinologist, and I truly believe that the Shroud of Turin is God's calling card, and that's what I call it.
Well, Elie Marzulli, I have to say thank you so much for being part of this.
Thank you, Ryan.
I thoroughly enjoyed this, and it was, like I said, the honor. The honor was all mine having you here. I really appreciate you coming here.
Well, thank you, sir, and we'll have to do it again.
Definitely, I totally agree, and we'll definitely keep in contact. You know, we're talking about maybe something in a year's time, maybe a trip or something like that. We'll keep in contact about that.
That could be really cool. That could be really cool next year.
Okay, that was L.A. Marzulli, and it was more than what I wanted. It was a fantastic interview, and he has so much to talk about. If you're watching this, listening to this, go check out his website, lamarzulli.net or lamarzulli.com. You know, check out his books, his videos, his streaming services. It is fantastic. And with that, I just want to say thank you to all my viewers and listeners, and make sure if you are listening, come over to the YouTube channel, subscribe and like it. And I'm sure you'll really enjoy this. So I want to also say again, keep your curiosity wandering and always keep the light lit.
I look forward to our next adventure together as we navigate the mysteries that lie ahead. Until our paths cross again, keep your curiosity wandering and ensure the light remains lit.